offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. As always, joining you this evening is Prem and Hari. We are in the middle of the 8th discourse in the 1991 Summer Course series. In fact, we are towards the end of that discourse. We'll be completing it today. It's about the Prashnopanishad, just like the previous two discourses. I think Swami is going to continue about it even the next discourse. To give you a brief summary of whatever Swami has spoken thus far and to take it forward to the conclusion, I invite Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prem.
I thought we will do a quick recap of the discourse, because as we know, the entire discourse is based on a few questions that some of these disciples ask sage Pipilada, right? And the way the discourse flows, I think it's important to see where it began and, you know, what was the beginning of that discussion itself. Because even as I was trying to briefly summarize what Swami has been saying, there is a lot of connectivity in that, in the sense of practically what we can take from what Swami is saying.
Right.
As we know, it starts off with three very, very profound questions that this disciple by name Suryayani is asking sage Pipilada. Right? And he asks, when we sleep, who sleeps and who is awake? Right? I mean, that itself suggests that he knows that there is somebody awake even while I am asleep.
Yes.
Right? And of course, that comes from the idea of one envisioning dreams while asleep. So that's why the second question goes, who dreams and who forgets the body and mind? So there is one entity in you which is awake, the other which is asleep. So he's asking who sleeps and who is awake. And when a prani sleeps, when an individual sleeps, who retains the prana? So these are the three very beautiful questions that he asks. And Swami explains that the answers which the sage gives him are, the senses are withdrawn during the sleep. And he gives the example of the sun, I think, just like how as night falls, the sun withdraws its rays, and the next morning again it spreads forth its rays. Swami gives that example. And then Swami says the five pranas are kept awake.
Yeah.
And I think you gave that example from the Upanishads, right?
That the metaphor they give is like, imagine that there is a village, and so the all the denizens of the village have gone to sleep, but they've, in that entire village, there are like five fires that are burning. So that is to say that the pranas are still alive. Like, though I mean, they are functioning, but while the other senses are withdrawn. Yeah.
Right. That's what he answers. And then he says the mind is the reason for dreams as well as deep sleep.
Yes.
That's an interesting thing. He says because the mind's activity is shown as dreams, the mind's absence is shown as deep sleep.
Yes.
So Swami is completely saying that, you know, so the one who is actually experiencing is the jiva, the individual soul experiences the peace of sleep.
In fact, if I remember right, Swami also states that it is the mind that is responsible for the, like, the mind creates a physical body, and then the mind is responsible for the prana entering that physical body.
Right.
So the it is, as Swami said, that the mind is, you know, primarily responsible for the for creation to happen.
I think in the previous discourse, Swami had a reference to that in the sense of, you know, what makes you wake up into that body every morning, right? You know, you go to deep sleep. The deep sleep state, the individual is completely cut off from the body and the senses. So what makes that individual wake back?
Correct.
So then I think Swami speaks about karma, how karma is the one which binds you to the body, and how that karma is related to one of the pranas. I think Swami says udana. Udana is the one which keeps that count of the actions that you do.
Yes.
Swami gives that example, and that's also very beautifully Swami connects the prani, the prana, and the body, and the experience of being awake, being asleep.
Yeah, how that continuity is maintained throughout. Yeah.
And then Swami says that the other disciple, I think his name is Satyakama, he comes and asks about pranava. He says that it is said that by the recitation of pranava, one can, in the last moments of one's life, one can attain immortality. Is it true? And then he goes on to explain about pranava in detail. Swami also speaks about that, how it is all encompassing, and the three lokas are contained in it, and all of creation is contained in it. All of the Vedas are nothing but the expression of that same pranava. And then there is this explanation which Swami gives, that merely by recitation of the pranava you only get worldly benefits.
Right.
But recitation with the significance kept in the mind gives you, you attain the Chandraloka, or the period after death when you are able to still continue, enjoy the benefits of your good deeds. I think that was what was said in the previous discourse, the difference between Chandraloka and Suryaloka. And I think this is the part where it's very beautiful. Swami says that, you know, humanness is transformed into divinity only when there is unity of thought, word and deed. So I think Swami says that that is what connects. If you say, merely by reciting the pranava will I have escape from the cycle of birth and death, Swami says it doesn't happen that way. Since the unity of thought, word and deed is the crux. So that recitation with the understanding of the significance of the pranava and actions which go with that. And it is only in that case that you actually transmute humanness into divinity.
And as we've been generally maintaining, see, the actions that we do, they come out of a deep understanding of our true nature, which is why inquiry is so very important. See, every time we inquire, who am I, we get a certain answer. And that answer dictates like what we think, what we act and what we do. Like I recall, you know, once earlier on one program I had said that I used to look at these interactions between, you know, the famous fictional detective pair. We had Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. So Sherlock Holmes is forever wearing that mantle of a detective. So when he sits across a person, his mind is always, you know, thinking about, like, observing very small little details about that person, deducing, you know, something about his past or what he has done, etc. Various inferences. But because that is an answer to his question to himself called, who am I? And his answer is, I'm a detective. I solve crimes. And therefore, the rest of it is consistent with that. His actions, thoughts, everything. Like a teacher. See, a teacher, as we know, never stops being a teacher. And so, wherever the teacher goes, he or she, whoever it is, you can see that they keep schooling whoever they meet. They keep correcting what they're saying. And because the answer to them is that, I am a teacher. And that never stops. So, I think that is the primal, very, very important, that is the importance, sorry, of that inquiry of who am I. Because it is the answer to a lot of things.
In fact, our own team member who does the proofreading for most of our articles and you know, does the quality check, he would often say this. You know, he gets into this problem even when he's sitting and probably listening to bhajans or you know, reading a casual document. Invariably, he you know, starts identifying the typos and the errors in the document. So he says it's very difficult for him to detach himself from that duty which he's assigned. In fact, I mean, going further, what you were saying about what you think of who I am is so very important. In fact, if you look at it, the primary duty of the mind, or the mind which is represented by the brain and the body, the whole idea of the brain, if you look at it, if you break it down to the various functions as they do it in neuroscience now, all of it, which all of the things which the brain does, is to sustain the body. Right? So it only means that the brain is kept there for the purpose of preserving this idea of self. Everything, you know, it tries to capture things which are good for the body. It tries to capture things which it believes are, because we are so, you know, this idea that I am the body is so very intertwined with this idea of I am the mind. As Professor Venkatraman would say, that you have this complete interlocking of desires of the body and the desires of the mind, which are actually quite different, but we don't differentiate between the two because we are this idea that I am the body and mind is so intertwined. So this brain all the time tries to gather everything which it believes is good for this personality.
So I wanted to point out that the brain actually, in addition to preserving the body, it preserves the identity. So much so that if at times it believes that that identity is, you know, identity is fulfilled by destroying the body, it will.
Right, exactly.
Like if we look at how like a typical jihadi that belief, you know, in suicide bombing. That is because they're so invested in the idea, you know, of that identity with what they believe is so strong that they're ready to sacrifice their own body for that. So the brain, you know, it goes beyond that.
Exactly,
function.
It starts trying to protect the ideas apart from just the body and the personality.
Exactly.
Whatever it identifies. In fact, that's what Swami would say, that always ahankara comes with mamakara, or the feeling of mind.
Yes.
So just as the mind is trying to protect the body and the personality, it starts trying to protect everything which the body claims as its own.
Precisely.
You know, my family, or my religion, my country, all of that.
Absolutely.
Right. So that is why it is so important, as Swami would say, to come back to that fundamental question of who am I, and try to refine that answer. In fact, when we were speaking to Bhagya sir, he was saying that. In the initial years when he had just become lecturer in Swami's college. So one day Swami had called him for an interview, and in the interview room, Swami, I think, asked him, so what do you do, what sadhana do you do? And at that point in time, he was doing constant namasmarana. He would say that even as I'm walking, I would be chanting Swami's name, and I'm sitting and eating, I'll be chanting Swami's name. So he said, Swami, I do namasmarana. So he said, ask the question, who am I? Okay, who am I? So he said, Swami, you are God, I know that, right? Because Swami said, who am I, right? He made no sense of it. He came out of the interview room and he's saying, why is Swami asking me to find out who he is, right? And that's when, just then, one of the other colleagues came and gave him this book by Ramana Maharishi, which had the title, Who Am I?
Oh, okay.
So it's then that it struck him that it's actually a sadhana by itself.
Right.
You know, constantly asking, who am I?
Yes, yes. Right. I remember we had Bhagya sir as a teacher. Like, he used to speak always of abiding in the self.
Right.
That we used to ask him, sir, like, what is the spiritual practice that you're undertaking? This is, of course, like many years after he had joined over here, and pretty much he had internalized what Swami had guided him. So his answer always used to be that I perform the sadhana of abiding in the self. And I had absolutely no background to even understand. What he was talking about. It was many years later that I truly, you know, like, I began to comprehend, you know, what he meant by that. Yeah? Like, not identifying with all that the brain answers, like, you know, who am I? Mm-hmm. So every time the answer comes, you not negate it, you observe that answer and then say, like, okay, what more? What next? Deeper.
Right.
So, yeah.
And after that, there's that part where Swami speaks about the Hiranyagarbha concept. And that again is very beautiful. I mean, from that same point of, you know, the mind creating this distinction.
Yeah.
Swami says this mind also creates this distinction of the inner world and the outer world. Because it's almost like that example that Swami would give of a pot with 9 holes. You know, the moment you break the pot, the atmosphere inside and the atmosphere outside becomes one. It was never two. It was never different or distinct. But it is this pot's presence which created that illusion. And Swami says it's the mind which creates this differentiation between the inner world and the outer world. And Swami says God manifests in the outer world as Vishwa. Right? In fact, we had Pradeep sir who gave a beautiful explanation of the different names, why it is called, why God was given the name Vishwa. And it's from there that concept of Vishwa Virat Swarupa or Vishwarupa comes. And we've heard even Brother Satyajit telling that.
Yes, and that was the exact experience that was coming to mind. Like, you could, I remember the first time when I heard Brother Satyajit actually telling me this experience, I was so underwhelmed. Really,
expected something grander.
Yes, so, the experience of course goes that, you know, Satyajit had asked Swami to show him the Vishwarupa Darshan. Yeah,
I think Swami had taken him in the car.
And said that I will...
Swami asked, whom do you want to see?
Yeah, okay.
Right.
So this was his prayer, that Vishwarupa Darshan. And that day, as they're going out, and Swami says, he want to see Vishwarupa Darshan, and here it is. So the throngs.
Right.
You know, the throngs of people. So that Swami's, you know, that... I wouldn't say conviction, but standing true to his vision that each one of us is divine. Right. So when he saw each one of us, that was the Vishwarupa Darshan.
Right.
You know, the highest truth expressed very simply. And you know, like initially, of course, I had thought that you know, Brother Satyajit would have seen some fantastic vision, as we see in the Gita's Gita. That is right. That is the darshan which was granted to Arjuna. So now, like compared to that, this seemed like so very ordinary. But in that ordinariness is something very, very extraordinary.
Right.
It is something our mind cannot comprehend. Right? It's so totally beyond the mind. Because Swami can see something that he wishes that we could all see. You know, that unity in all of us.
Right. In fact, that's right. It's so beautiful that it's actually a Vedic concept where they say that God manifests in the outer world.
Exactly.
And he is referred to as Vishwa.
You
know, he's called in that by that name, or even Vishnu is supposed to be a name given from that you know, who is all-pervasive.
All-pervasive.
Right,
yes.
It's called Vishnu. And then Swami says that the same divinity, when it is within, is in the form of this Hiranyagarbha, or that state of, you know, ever ready to give forth creation. That's what Swami would tell, especially when during the Shivratri time when Swami would materialize the lingam and call it the Hiranyagarbha, Swami would say that all of creation comes forth from this. And Swami explained further that why is it called Hiranya? Hiranya is the word for gold in Sanskrit. Swami said, gold is unchanging. In fact, that's why we use gold as currency, right? That's why it becomes a commodity which, in which we can store value in, right? Because gold does not change over time.
Right.
And they say that there is only a limited quantity of gold. You can't increase or deplete it.
It's immutable.
Right. Yeah. So Swami says that's why the concept of Hiranyagarbha, you know, I mean, it's so beautiful that so many years ago, the term given was so appropriate to the concept.
Yeah.
Right? Swami is talking about that, and then of course Swami explained that the Hiranyagarbha is in the heart,
right,
which is actually not the world, the physical heart, but the spiritual heart, which is in the right. And as I think the 1990 Guru Purnima, Swami spoke extensively about this Hridaya, which is in the right side. And Swami says that this feeling of I actually arises from there.
Right.
And it's in that nascent stage. It has got no attachments to any form or any worldly possessions. It is that pure Hiranyagarbha, in that sense of only that aham.
The awareness of
the
existence.
Yeah, just the consciousness. Aham, 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 Swami says. That is what is the Hiranyagarbha. So Swami speaks about that. And of course, from that, very beautifully, Swami transitioned into the idea of illusion.
Right.
When there is only one, how does it appear as two? Swami gave the classic example of the snake and the rope. And I think last week we went into the differentiation between science and spirituality in their approach.
Yes.
Right? I think that's where we were last time. So I think we'll go to the next clip. We've got two clips, so we'll mostly complete it today.
Yes.
Self-confidence is all avasaram.
Dear students, self-confidence is very important.
Mee yokka aatmavishwasanni meer abhirudhi parchukondi.
Develop your self-confidence.
Ee aatmaku minchinatvanti marokati lene ledu.
There is nothing more excellent than
vaaku, manasu, pranamu, moodinti yokka sammilitamaina swaroopame aatma.
Atma is a combination of vaak, word, manas, mind and prana, the life principle.
కనుక ఈ మూడింటి యొక్క తత్వం లోపల ప్రాణము చాలా ప్రధానం.
అమంగ్ దీస్ త్రీ ప్రాణ ఈజ్ ది మోస్ట్ ఇంపార్టెంట్ వన్.
ప్రాణములకు అంత్యము లేదు.
దేర్ ఇస్ నో ఎండ్.
ప్రాణమున్న దేహానికి అంత్యం ఉందని కానీ ప్రాణానికి అంత్యం లేదు.
ఫర్ ది ఫిజికల్ బాడీ ఇన్ విచ్ ప్రాణ దేర్ ఈస్ ఎన్ ఎండ్ ఫర్ ది బాడీ.
అది సర్వ జీవులు ఎందుకూడను అర్థమునందు ప్రతిబింబించినట్టుగా ప్రతిబింబిస్తూ ఉంటుంది.
ఇన్ ఆల్ లివింగ్ బీయింగ్స్ ఇట్ ఈస్ ప్రాణ విచ్ ఇస్ రిఫ్లెక్టింగ్ యాజ్ ఎ రిఫ్లెక్షన్ ఇన్ ఎ మిర్రర్.
కేవలం ఒకటి మాత్రమే ఉండినంత మాత్రం చాలదు.
It is not sufficient if there is only one.
Manasu, vaku, pranam.
There should be these three, the mind, the world and prana, life principle.
Ee moodinti chetane atma anetuvanti naluguvadi prarambhamavutundi.
From these three emerge the principle of atma, the fourth one.
Meek andariki telisina rasayana shastram lopala aneka chemicals anta kuda mix chesinappudu adi inkoka rakamainatundi phalitam vastuntadi.
All of you know, in chemistry, when you mix various compounds, you get new compounds.
అదే విధముగాని తాంబూలం వేసుకునేటువంటి వారు.
సిమిలర్ ఇస్ వన్ హూ టేక్స్ ద బీటల్ లీవ్స్ అండ్ నట్.
నట్ ఎట్లా ఉంటుంది? బ్రౌన్ గా ఉంటుంటది.
బీటల్ నట్స్ కలర్ ఇస్ బ్రౌన్.
బీటల్ లీవ్స్ ఎట్లా ఉంటుంటది? గ్రీన్ గా ఉంటుంటది.
బీటల్ లీవ్స్ కలర్ ఇస్ గ్రీన్.
చున్నం ఎట్లా ఉంటుంది? తెల్లగా ఉంటుంది.
చున్నం కలర్ ఈజ్ వైట్.
చున్నము తెలుపు, బీటల్ నట్ బ్రౌన్, బీటల్ లీవ్ గ్రీన్. మూడు చేతులకి రెడ్ కలర్ వస్తుంటుండాలి.
బట్ వెన్ యు కంబైన్ దిస్ బ్రౌన్ గ్రీన్ అండ్ వైట్ కలర్,
అదేవిధముగానే మానవుని యొక్క మనస్సు, మానవుని యొక్క మాట, మానవుని యొక్క ప్రాణము మూడు చేరేటప్పటికీ అదే ఆత్మస్వరూపాన్ని ధరిస్తుండాలి.
సిమిలర్లీ మ్యాన్స్ మైండ్, మ్యాన్స్ వర్డ్ అండ్ మ్యాన్స్ లైఫ్ కమ్ టుగెదర్, దెన్ ఇట్ బికమ్స్
అదే నిజమైన మ్యాన్ కైండ్.
దట్ ఈస్ రియల్ మ్యాన్ కైండ్.
ఆ మూడింటి యొక్క ఏకత్వం చేతనే మన జీవితాన్ని సార్థకం చేసుకోవాలి.
బై ది యూనిటీ ఆఫ్ దీస్ ట్రినిటీ, దీస్ త్రీ, వీ హావ్ టు శాంక్టిఫై అవర్ లైఫ్.
కనుక ప్రతి ఒక్కటి కూడాను మానవుని యొక్క హృదయం నుండే ఉంటున్నావు, కానీ బయట ప్రపంచంలో లేవు.
దేర్ ఫోర్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్ ఈజ్ విత్ ఇన్ మ్యాన్స్ హార్ట్. యూ డోంట్ గెట్ దెమ్ ఇన్ ది ఎక్స్టర్నల్ వరల్డ్.
దానిని పురస్కరించుకుని సుషుమ్నావస్థలో ఉండినటువంటి వాడిని హిరణ్య గర్భాయ నమః అన్నారు.
ఇన్ దిస్ కాంటెక్స్ట్ వన్ హూ ఈజ్ ఇన్ ది స్టేట్ ఆఫ్ సుషుమ్న ఈజ్ డిస్క్రైబ్డ్ యాజ్ హిరణ్య గర్భ.
అందులోనే అమితమైన ఆనందం ఉంటుండాలి.
ఇన్ దట్ స్టేట్ వన్ గెట్స్ సుప్రీం బ్లిస్.
ఒక బాహ్య దీంట్లో ఒక చిన్న ఉదాహరణగా తీసుకోండి.
యూ టేక్ ఎన్ ఎక్స్టర్నల్ ఎగ్జాంపుల్.
ఏదో ఒక కాపర్ చిక్కితే మనం అంత సంతోషపడము.
When we get a piece of copper, we are not happy.
ఏదో ఇంత ఎండి ముక్క చిక్కితే మనం సంతోషపడము.
We don't get happy when we get a silver piece.
ఇంత బ్రాస్ ముక్క చిక్కితే సంతోషపడము.
Not even when we get a piece of brass.
కానీ బంగారం చిక్కితే మాత్రం చాలా సంతోషిస్తాం.
But the moment we get gold, we are so much overjoyed.
కనుకనే ఈ నిజమైనటువంటి గోల్డ్ అనేటువంటిది ఒక విధమైనటువంటి హృదయాన్ని ఆహ్లాదపరుస్తుంది.
Real gold gives joy to the heart.
ఈ గోల్డ్ అంటే ఏమిటి?
What do you mean by gold?
అది మట్టే.
It is also mud.
కానీ మట్టి ఎక్కడ చూసినా చిక్కుతుంది కనుక అది చాలా చీప్ గా మనం ఉపయోగపెట్టుకుంటున్నాం.
As you can find mud anywhere, it doesn't have that space.
ఆ మట్టిలోనే గోల్డ్ ఎక్కడో ఒక చోట చిక్కుతుంది కనుకనే దానికి ప్రత్యేకమైన విలువనిస్తున్నాం.
As gold is found rarely in mud and earth, you have
got gold కూడా నువ్వు సర్వత్రా చిక్కితే దీనికి కూడా ఎవరు విలువ ఇవ్వరు.
If unlimited gold is available everywhere, there is no value even for gold.
Kanaka mana jeevitham lopala sarvatra yemukalu, raktamu, maamsamu, kandaramulu ilanti vanta untunnayi, deeniki evaru viluvivatam ledu.
In our physical body there are bones, blood, muscles. You don't give so much of value.
Kani aa hrudayamu adi oka bangaru gunda velaga cheesukuntunnaru.
But when it is heart, we treat it as if it is gold and give a lot of value to it.
Kanuka hiranya garbhudu anaga manavatvaniki viluvana prasadinchetundi, manavatvaniki tejasthanu prasadinchetundi, manavatvaniki adarshanni prasadinchetundi, manavatvaniki manavatvanni prasadinchetundi yokka hrudayame hiranya garbhamu.
So when you say hiranya garbha, it is the one which gives value to man, which gives resplendence to man, which gives the humanity itself man, which gives an ideal to man.
That was the first clip. I mean, one more clip to go. So Swami is again reiterating the point where, you know, what makes this Hiranyagarbha so special, right? Yeah, and Swami is talking of these two qualities. I think we mentioned the previous one of gold's immutability, you know, that being the reason why we refer to this special thing inside as Hiranyagarbha. And now Swami is mentioning about the rarity of the commodity of gold, right, making it precious, right?
Yeah, and in an earlier discourse also, Swami, he had spoken about like what is very important for every youth to first of all develop self confidence, and it's not as if youth don't have confidence. So, you know, like typically they have the swagger which we mistake as confidence, but Swami is very clear that the self he is referring to is self, the actual self, like I think we had a discussion in the last segment or the last discourse also when we were discussing that how we mistake like what confidence is. So we mistake confidence for reliance on our abilities,
right?
For example, and what, so we question ourselves that what happens if we meet somebody who has better abilities than we have. So does that confidence need to disappear? Or, you know, as some adverse circumstances, things don't turn out the way we expected them to, like, does it mean our confidence has to evaporate? So Swami says, you got to therefore rely on something that is in itself immutable. And that has to be your self. So that, I think, very important message again, like for the students, right?
And I think it comes from the previous clip which we played, which was about man creating machines and having too much confidence in the accuracy of the machines. Some of you are saying that in a sense you're actually, you know, outsourcing your confidence. Instead of having the confidence on yourself, who's the creator of the machine,
exactly.
You create a machine and you have confidence in the machine.
In the machine.
And as you said, in the absence of the machine, you don't have confidence in your own self.
Yeah.
And I think that's precisely the case with many of us. You know, thanks to or curse the auto spell check on our email, on our computer, right? We're so very clueless without that when we have to write something on a piece of paper, right?
Exactly. And I recall when I was young, I used to visit my uncle's office every now and then. I used to watch, you know, how the typists, they would type with like near zero error.
Right.
And they had to perfect that ability because there's no, you know, remedy in case you make a mistake even once, right?
Yeah, you can't even rub board.
You have to strike it out and look very ugly. Right. But now we just type in and we don't give much thought. We say that anyway, spell check is there, you know, for me too. So as you rightly said, we surrendered a lot of our brain's capacities to our smartphones, to our computers, you know, so it's, like Swami's not, to reiterate, it's not that Swami's against technology. Is Swami's against that so complete over-reliance on technology where you begin to neglect the faculties, neglect to use the faculties that you yourself possess.
Right. Going by the explanations which Swami generally gives, even in the, I think, second or third discourse where Swami was speaking about the levels of you have the Atma which animates the mind and the mind which rules over the senses and kind of processes the things which the senses gives. And Swami says that is where the Atma is most important because it's almost like the energy source of the whole thing. I think the same thing we've taken it to a different level, And there Swami was saying that because Atma is the one which animates all of this, that's the most important. Now Swami is saying that, you created all these gadgets, but because you're the one who has actually created them, you're more important than the gadgets. It's almost the same logic which Swami is using, and Swami is extending that too. So similarly, just like how it is absurd to place your confidence on gadgets instead of the human intellect, it is also absurd to place your confidence on your intellect instead of the divinity within, in the same logic.
Yes.
Right? That's what Swami is suggesting here. And then this part, I don't know how exactly to explain that, where Swami says that the Atma is a combination of mind, speech and the prana, or the life force.
Yes.
Right? And Swami gives that beautiful example of the palm leaves. I wonder if 91 Swami was still
chewing
palm. I'm not too sure. Right. But I think more than just going by the words as such, like mind and speech, I think Swami is suggesting that the process of thinking as well as the process of expression.
Yeah.
Right? Swami, it not necessarily means speech in the way of spoken word. Right?
Yeah. But again, I think it's, we're looking at the same theme of unity of thought, word and deed.
Right.
Like when Swami says that man's mind, speech and life force come together, the Atma is revealed. As several times Swami has said, that manasekam, vachasekam, karmanyekam, mahatmanam.
Right.
So it is that when we make sure that our thought, word and deed are aligned, Right, and that is when the Swami says that the true nobility is revealed. Mm. Otherwise, we are always, you know, debasing ourselves.
Right.
That I think the several times we come back to this theme of, you know, like when we try to act for our survival more than, you know, for the principle rather than stand for the principle, and every time we do that, we are not being our true self.
Right.
And so that's why the moment we align the three, we are being our true self.
Hmm.
Right? That is, we are bigger than the circumstances, that we are not identified so much ourselves with the mind and body, like with the personality, but rather the principle of divinity. That right. moment, it gets revealed. So that is why I think almost like the Swami is harping again and again on this unity of thought, word and deed.
Right. In fact, I think a couple of weeks back we had played that part where Swami very beautifully defined dharma, satya and ahimsa.
Hmm.
And he said, act upon what is within you.
Right.
That is right conduct or dharma. To speak clearly and honestly of the matters in your heart is truth. To think about the matters in your heart truthfully and clearly is peace or shanti. To understand your heart is non-violence.
Yes.
Right? It's a very, I think it's a different view of these five words. Because even when we say unity of thought, word, indeed, we discussed last time how there is a misunderstanding of, you know, whatever you think you speak. Right? That's then it's like being a loose cannon. That's not the idea of the thing.
The antithesis.
Right. Yeah. Swami is saying that, you know, I think even earlier Swami would say that, even that famous Sanskrit shloka which says that priyam satyam bruyat, priyam bruyat. You know, it says that there is many levels in which this whole idea of what is to be spoken is, you know, verified upon.
Mm.
One is, of course, it has to be truthful. But what is the point if truth is spoken and it is going to cause harm and not benefit anybody around and yourself?
Yeah. Or said in a hurtful way.
Right. Yeah. So I think that can happen only when you are, as Swami was saying, that you're in tune with your conscience. You're, you know, what is in your heart, you do it. What is in your heart, you speak it. What is in your heart, you know, contemplate upon it. Right. And then Swami was again going back to this concept of Hiranyagarbha and saying that this again, I think, is a concept I'm totally unaware of. Swami is talking about the Sushumna state. Where at the Sushumna state, the mind is in the undisturbed, joyous mind, which is the Hiranyagarbha.
Because just some time ago you were mentioning, you know, that Swami in an earlier discourse, he had mentioned that that unsullied, the principle of awareness, which has not identified itself with any particular thing called I am this particular body or I am this particular person, that, you know, what pristine.
Right.
Principle. So that is the Hiranyagarbha.
Right.
Like everything else is built upon that. Right. So that's why the Sushumna state is, as the translation says, the state of an undisturbed, joyous mind. Right. When you're completely retreated, you know, you're like not identified with any of these, you're back to that original principle. So that is, that state is a completely equable state. You know.
Right.
So, and I think, yeah, because, you know, whenever I think of this equable mind, like one example I remember, like the comparison is between a bowl of water and a bowl of honey. Right? So how in our ordinary experience, the mind will get disturbed by any stimulus. Right? So what differentiates like a seeker and an ordinary person is when we develop our mind to be like honey. Right, ordinarily our minds are like water. Throw a small stone and it'll ripple, and the ripples, they touch like literally every corner. Right,
right.
So they spread out. And but when it comes to honey, they say like if you just tap the bowl of honey, it'll go like once. The viscosity is so good that it goes up maybe once to a small extent and then it returns, never to again, you know, oscillate. So if we can develop our minds to that is a state. You know, it's such a beautiful example we can use in our like everyday life. Right? And that, as I said, no, a lot of these things they only come with by immersing ourselves in this idea. Like when Swami says that it is the Sushumna state. So it is very easy for us to dismiss it, saying that that is a very abstruse or a very high state that we cannot attain. But then why would Swami place such an ideal in front of us if it were not for us to, you know, aspire to it? So always think of that. Like, so whenever we have a breakdown, like wherever the, you know, the mind flees or it is totally so disturbed, these ideals, like Swami keeps on, you know, embedding them in our mind so that we think of it at that moment, you know, when you're just about to lose it, when you're going to get thrown off the horse. At that moment, if you can recall, like, how to survive, you know, with all these ideas imprinted, at least in Swami, out of his compassion, he speaks about these in so many different ways. Like now, if he says it's like the Hiranyagarbha, so that you should identify yourself with that golden principle of who you truly are, I can imagine that for someone it resonates. You know, so if like every day morning they visualize, you know, that they are like this, the golden principle, immutable, unchanged by anything that happens, maybe it clicks for them. You know, and then for someone else, that concept of, you know, that something like man is more valuable than all the wealth in the world, maybe that clicks for them. You know, but in the end, it is like the compassionate Lord just giving us so many different accesses to that one same, you know, divinity.
Right.
So that is so beautiful to observe. Like, even when I was listening to this, I was thinking, like, maybe we've heard this in so many different ways, but I was just thinking, which one of these, you know, will click for whom?
Right. Yeah, I think the ability to do that is in the conscious mind. Swami was saying, and even when Swami says, ask the question, who are you? Ask the, you know, consciously detach yourself from all of these objects that you attach yourself to. And going back to that example that you gave of that, you know, a trough of water which, you know, when disturbed, causes ripples and then comes back. I would often think of that. You know, there is looking at it from the point of view of a system of equilibrium. Right? You're disturbing the equilibrium.
Right.
It goes off the equilibrium, and after a certain period of time, it can come back to the equilibrium if not disturbed further.
Yes.
So I would think that, you know, there, if you see, time is the healer in a sense, right? Time has the ability to bring back the equilibrium. So I would think even in our minds, that's what it is. Right now, if somebody comes and accuses you, or, you know, speaks ill of you, your mind's equilibrium is disturbed. But Swami is saying that there is a time after that disturbance happens where you can think, you know, who is he actually abusing or who is he actually accusing? Am I really, you know, responsible for the mistake which he's pointing at me? And Swami is saying that, you know, to start with, that time required for your equilibrium to come back will be longer. But with time, it can happen actually instantly. So instantly that, infinitely instantly, that there is no change at all. No, you go into that state probably like that honey, which is a very high viscous, almost a solid state where nothing disturbs it.
No, I you know, it's one Shivratri discourse, like when Swami was talking about that episode in Shankaracharya's life, right, where he's walking with his disciples and Lord Shiva takes the form of a chandala, or, you know, a low caste person, and comes in his way. And so when he is upset, you know, that, and he starts telling in very strong words, he's asking the chandala to move out of his way. That is when the chandala reminds him that, you know, whom are you abusing right now, or who should move out of the way? Like, are you addressing me as the body, in which case, like, I am not the body and I will, you know, therefore I cannot move. And if you are referring to my Atma, the Atma is ever present everywhere. So how, where is it that it can move? So it's very powerful. Very powerful, because like it is a powerful reminder to Shankaracharya himself. You know, that for that moment, he has forgotten the true principle of who they both are.
Right.
And so Swami says, like, and in fact, Swami went on to explain, like, a very abstruse concept. And Swami said the same thing you can all do, you know. Like, when you are, when a person abuses you, what you can say to yourself is, whom are you abusing? You know, so use that opportunity to inquire. Like, most of us would get upset, oh, like, you know, right now my esteem is being hurt. But Swami says, use that opportunity to again inquire, like, who am I? Whom is he abusing? So that is a... this is what I recall, just the point that I was mentioning, that so many different accesses Swami gives to the same. And ultimately, for Swami, the highest, the hallmark of a devotee was equanimity. Right, that state of mind where
absolutely
neither joy nor loss, where neither adversity, you know, nor prosperity, neither fame nor blame, none of these would, you know, affect you as much, that you would continue completely, you know, placid.
Right.
So that was, for Swami, that was the hallmark of a devotee. And so all of these is like, so abiding in that, you know, like these messages or these teachings is what will get us there.
Right. In fact, what, I mean, even as you're saying about equanimity, I mean, in many ways, in fact, probably you could take this path of looking at yourself, I'm not the body, I'm the mind, and, you know, that path of vichara or, you know, self-contemplation, or as you're saying about Bhagya sir, abiding in the self. You could take that path, or simply, as Swami would say, you know, in the letter which Swami writes to his brother, in that he says, this is my task, this is what I love doing, this is what I want to do. There Swami slips in one line. He says, to keep equanimity, you know, at the face of difficulties and at the face of, you know, happiness,
yeah,
is devotion for me.
Okay.
So Swami redefines devotion, saying that even if you want to, don't, you know, none of these appeal to you, you want to approach the whole concept as a devotee. And this is what is devotion for me.
Right.
Right? I think that's same thing what it's said in the Gita.
Yeah, because I think that is where many of us fail, you know. Like we take up that spiritual path, like we something that Swami has advised. And at that moment we start encountering all those thoughts which we have like so far never encountered. All those parts of ourselves which we never knew existed, you know, like the nasty parts. Like we begin to confront that. And many of us get put off, or we justify that, or... No, but, you know, a few days ago, I was reading something very interesting. A person said, you know, that if video games or computer games have taught me anything, it is that when you are encountering enemies, you are going, you know, you are proceeding on the right path. Because in a video game, if like, you know, like if you are going in a direction where you don't encounter anybody, it means you are, you know, not in the... So if you're going in the right direction, you will encounter a lot of these enemies.
Right. So I think we'll go to the last clip in that discourse.
Right. Okay.
Vidyarthulara, ee prashnoparishat yokka bhavamu meeku chaala artham kaaka nenu mimmalni chaala shrama pettutunnanu.
Dear students, the contents of prashnoparishat are rather hard.
ఈనాటితో ఈ ప్రశ్నోపనిషత్తు వదిలిపెట్టి ఇంకా నిత్య జీవితం లోపల మానవునికి అత్యవసరమైనటువంటి యొక్క విషయాల లోపల మనము ఈ మిగిలిన దినాలంతా కూడా మనం ఉపయోగపెట్టుకుందాం.
విత్ టుడే వీఆర్ పుట్టింగ్ అన్ ఎండ్ టు దిస్ ప్రశ్నోపనిషత్. వీఆర్ టేకింగ్ అప్ మ్యాటర్స్ రిలేటెడ్ టు
గొప్ప గొప్ప వేదాంతులకే పండితులకే అర్థం కాదు.
గ్రేట్ స్కాలర్స్ అండ్ గ్రేట్ వేదాంతిన్స్ హావ్ నాట్ బీన్ ఏబుల్ టు అండర్స్టాండ్.
సామాన్యమైనటువంటి యొక్క మీ పిల్లలకు ఏదో ఒక ఇంగ్లీష్ పదములు చదువుకునేటువంటి వాళ్లకు ఇది అంతకంటే అర్థం కాదు.
ఫర్ ఆర్డినరీ స్టూడెంట్స్ హూ ఓన్లీ నో ఎ ఫ్యూ వర్డ్స్ ఆఫ్ ఇంగ్లీష్ హార్డ్లీ కెన్ దే అండర్స్టాండ్ దిస్ ఉపనిషత్.
ఆంగ్ల భాషకు విలువిస్తున్నారు కానీ ఆత్మ భాషకు విలువ ఇవ్వటం లేదు.
యూఆర్ గివింగ్ వాల్యూ ఫర్ ఇంగ్లీష్ లాంగ్వేజ్ నాట్ ఫర్ ద లాంగ్వేజ్ ఆఫ్ ది హార్ట్.
కనుక అలాంటి సమయం లోపల ఇంత విలువైనటువంటివి చెప్పినప్పటికీ దాని సరైనటువంటి అర్థాన్ని మీరు తీసుకోవటం అసాధ్యము.
ఈవెన్ దో సచ్ ప్రెషియస్ థింగ్స్ ఆర్ టోల్డ్, it is impossible for you to understand and take them in the right way.
చదివేటువంటి పిల్లవాడికి పదవ తరగతి క్లాస్ బుక్ చెప్తే వాడికి ఏం అర్థమవుతుంది?
హౌ కెన్ ఎ పర్సన్ హూ ఇస్ స్టడీ ఇన్ ఫస్ట్ స్టాండర్డ్ అండర్స్టాండ్ 10th స్టాండర్డ్ బుక్స్?
కనుక మీకు ఆ తరగతి బుక్ ని మీకు అందించి ఆ తరగతికి సంబంధించినటువంటి యొక్క దీన్ని క్లాస్ ని తీసుకున్నప్పుడు మీకు సులభంగా హృదయానికి హత్తుకుంటుంది.
ఓన్లీ వెన్ ద బుక్స్ అండ్ ది మ్యాటర్ రిలేటింగ్ అండ్ అప్రోప్రియేట్ టు దట్ స్టాండర్డ్ ఆర్ గివన్ యూ విల్ బి ఏబుల్ టు అండర్స్టాండ్ క్లియర్లీ అండ్ ఈజీలీ.
కనుక రేపటి నుంచి
ఫ్రమ్ టుమారో ఆన్వర్డ్
మానవునికి ప్రధానమైనటువంటి విజ్ఞానము,
ద సైన్స్ విచ్ ఇస్ ఇంపార్టెంట్ ఫర్ మ్యాన్,
కర్మ మార్గము,
ది పాత్ ఆఫ్ యాక్షన్,
నిత్య జీవితంలో అనుభవించవలసినటువంటి ధర్మ మార్గము,
ద రైచియస్నెస్ విచ్ మస్ట్ బి ప్రాక్టీస్ ఇన్ డే టు డే లివింగ్,
కర్తవ్య తత్వములు
అండ్ డ్యూటీస్ ఆబ్లిగేషన్స్,
లౌకిక జీవితంలో ఉండేటువంటి అర్థములు
అండ్ ద వేరియస్ థింగ్స్ విచ్ ఆర్ ఇంపార్టెంట్ ఫర్ విచారి వరల్డ్
అత్యవసరము.
It is necessary to look into
the kala paristhiti prabhavanu puraskarinchukoni,
keeping in view the needs of the
vidyarthulaku naitika bhautika dharmakamulu bodhinchatamu chala pradhanamu.
it is necessary to teach the students the moral principles and the ethical principles and the worldly things also.
ఈ సైన్స్ పెరిగే కొలది నైతిక విలువ దినదినమునకు దిగజారిపోతుంటుంది.
As science is making progress, the moral values are declining proportionately day after day.
కనుక మానవుని యొక్క విలువలే లేనప్పుడు ఏ సైన్స్ అభివృద్ధి ప్రయోజనం ఏమిటి?
If there are no human values, what is the use of progress being made by science in any?
ఈనాటి విద్యలు ఏ విధంగా ఉంటున్నాయంటే చాలా ప్రోగ్రెస్ పెరిగిపోతున్నాయి.
People describe today's education as if it is making very good progress.
Niti niyamalu gramdhana nilichipoye.
Morality and good conduct are
kalpayamantayu surganda malanamaye.
Heart has become rather polluted and full of dirty smell.
Chetulantayu swaktham puchetulaye.
Hands have become highly selfish.
Idiye progress inadu vidyalandu.
This is the progress which you are achieving in education today.
Vidya nerpinavanini vekkirinchu.
Making fun of the one who has given education.
Koodu vettinavanini kuladroyu.
Ruining a person who has given you food.
Meru chesina vaniki keedu cheyu.
Harming one who has done good for you.
Idi e progress tu inadu vidyalandu.
This is the type of progress achieved in education today.
Progress ida progress.
What is this kind of progress? Is it progress?
Kaadu.
No, certainly not.
Krutagnata manavuniki pradhanamaina pranamu.
Gratitude is the life breath for man.
మనం ఎవరి వలన ఏ యొక్క మంచిని మనం పొందినామో వాడికి జీవితం అంతా కూడా ఆ యొక్క కృతజ్ఞతను మనం అందించాలి.
వీ హావ్ టు ఆఫర్ గ్రాటిట్యూడ్ ఫర్ ఆల్ దోస్ పీపుల్ ఫ్రమ్ హూమ్ వీ హావ్ టేకన్ ఈవెన్ ఎనీ బెనిఫిట్స్.
గురువులను గౌరవించాలి.
Respect teachers.
తల్లిదండ్రులను ప్రేమించాలి.
Love parents.
తోటి మానవులు మానవులుగా భావించి సన్నిహిత సంబంధ బాంధవ్యాన్ని పెంచుకోవాలి.
Consider the other human being as a human being and establish appropriate.
ఇలాంటి సమరసమే భావమే లేకపోతే ఈ చదువుల యొక్క సారమేమిటి?
If only you don't have this kind of appropriate approach towards people,
chaduvulato paatu samskaraanni kudanu penchukovali babu.
Along with education there is need for samskaras being developed.
Karuka ee samskaramunaku sariyante saruku repati nunchi manam andukundam.
From tomorrow onwards we'll start understanding things which are appropriate for samskaras.
So that's the conclusion of that discourse, and I was just seeing the Padyam with which Swami started the discourse. Mm-hmm. Precisely, it was about purity of mind, being guileless, and being in a state where you don't wish to harm others or to benefit from others' suffering. And so very beautifully, you know, it's really been a very profound discourse. Swami is explaining so many Vedantic concepts. But at the end of it, the intensity with which Swami says that it's all of this is of no point if it does not express itself as samskaras or your ability to see your companion, the people around you, as divine, as at least a human being. Forget about looking at them as divine. If you're not able to treat them with the same respect that you expect from them, then none of these lessons are useful.
Yeah. Even as listening to that, my mind was thrown back to our MBA days, recalling the so many different occasions where Swami, like in very casual conversation with either with teachers or with some of us, but the main thing that Swami was again and again he was teaching us was in fact these values, the samskaras which Swami was speaking about, right? And Swami speaking it in a discourse is one thing, but being right there and training you in that from time to time, right? Like I recall almost my first or second week here as a student, there was some prasadam that was being distributed, and I was asked, Swami directed me to go to the VIPs who were sitting in the veranda and that I should go and distribute the prasadam to them. And just as about to, Swami said, A. So I came back to Swami and Swami kept saying, bag. So I didn't understand what Swami was saying. Luckily, one of the attendants, he came to me, he said, Swami is saying you should the prasadam, you should first put it in a plastic cover and then you should distribute, you know. So Swami was so very sensitive to these things that some of the things which no matter what you do, you're not trained in those things. Right, like Swami was very, very particular, like how guests should be served, you know. These, they look like very practical, very mundane things, but for Swami, this is what really, you know, was true divine education.
Right.
A few days ago, I met a person, like he was talking to me about, you know, he is placed very high in corporate, you know, the ladder, and I'm asking him, you know, what do you look for in a recruit? The kind of people you want around you. So he says, you know, initially you are swayed by all the degrees that the person has, you know. So he says in the initial years when you would recruit, this is what he would look at. Which institution did you come from? Like, what kind of degrees do you have? But over time, he realized that what the job demands, the training that the job demands, you can give it in no time. You know, and as you work, you pick up some things. But what is attitude, the culture, the outlook that you have, that is something that is so very difficult in the work environment, you know, to be trained in, right? And he says that instead of spending time on trying to mend a person's attitude, I look for that now. So in an interview, when I'm interviewing a person, what I'm looking for is, like, does he have this ability to work with people around him? Right, what they call as stress interviews nowadays. Like, can you be a team player or would you be like an individualistic person? So he says that now I look for those attitudes. And this is what Bhagwan was training in. You know, the secular education was left to the, you know, within the portals of the institute from the books and whatever the teachers had learnt in their experience. But what Bhagwan on a day-to-day basis, right, very small things, the way he would sit and the way when somebody is speaking, you know, not, you know, the way you pay attention to them. So very small details for him. And I think as I, you know, look at my classmates, many of them who are in the corporate world now, I think that's what distinguishes them. You know, they say that, you know, that it's very easy sometimes for the employer to look at another person and ask, you know, so is he also a Sai student? They discover it because of you know, that very similar, you know, nature of how they carry themselves around.
Right.
Because what, like he was saying, that the boss would say that I want more of your students in my company. Why? Because they're not trying to, you know, show off. Very simply, they're not coming here bragging about, you know, what their education is, who they're all about. Not trying to prove things. Like, you guys, you people, you come with that attitude of I want to learn more. Right. That humility, that willingness to listen. And he says, like, that for me is priceless. I could do with more of such students.
And when we were talking to some of our teachers, they were telling in the initial years, whenever there was a conference, we had the cardiac conference, or we would have some of these state heads from other countries visiting us. And every time whenever an important guest would come, Swami would appoint some boys who would be would take care of the hospitality. And in the initial years, you know, Swami would train them about that. You know, of course, when we all came, these teachers would train us. Right? But in those initial years, and he would say, one of these teachers was telling us that one thing which was characteristic about Swami checking whether you have got the room ready is Swami would walk into the room and go straight to the bathroom and check if the commode is clean. And he said, as students, when we saw Swami doing that, nothing more is required to, you know, drive that lesson in. You know, here is the person who is right on top of this entire pyramid of the entire organization. You know, he is the one who is the main person for whom everybody is coming to come. And he is going to that last, the least most important in our idea. And he's saying we have to check that because that is culture. You know, that is concern, right? And that's what Swami embodied. And in fact, when Swami is talking about education and progress, and Swami is saying that, you know, so beautifully and powerfully, Swami says, I mean, it's so powerful what Swami is saying here. He's saying that those who imparted education, you're deriding them. Those who are feeding you, you're starving them. And those who are serving you, you are, you know, harming them. This is what is education done. In fact, I mean, if we have someone like Professor Venkatraman just speak about these three lines, I'm sure, you know, he would have a field day. Because this is exactly what we're doing, you know, be it in the field of agriculture, I mean, the statistics are so very scary. Mm. You've had just in this year 1,000 farmer suicides.
Right.
In one state in India. Because there's something seriously we're doing wrong, and that's what has progress done in many ways. So Swami is saying that if education is useless because of this progress, you sitting through an entire discourse of Upanishads is useless if at the end of that, that's the same result.
Right.
Right? I mean, you're just replacing secular education with spiritual education.
Mm.
If at the end of it, you're going to go back and do the same thing.
Exactly. Like, I think it's a very sobering message actually that should go out, you know, as we try to establish more and more institutes of excellence in this country and the world over. See, like, universities, they vie with each other for rankings. And what are they ranked on? You know, they always ranked on, like, how well the students get placed or how many research papers come out. But nobody is really ranking them on, like, are you a finished product as right. you come out? And how much, you know, do you adhere to values in your daily life? I wish, like, that was the output.
Mm.
You know, I wish, you know, that the grade card, as in our institute grade card, it, you know, it reflects, like, what kind of person you were, like, how integrated and how disciplined you were, right? If that kind of grade card were also to come out with you, right? If that were held as important by the institutes. See, what I recall is, presently the system goes that in, while you're in school, the teachers do try to inculcate values.
Mm.
You know, and there are special classes, like at least in the Indian curriculum, where they teach you about how to be a moral person. The moment you transition from, you know, the 10th class into the 11th and 12th and beyond, all that is set aside and it purely becomes like a career-oriented teaching. You know, at no point of time do you find a teacher trying to inculcate discipline in you or anything, you know. And as you go into college, it becomes all the more pronounced. At least while you're in the 11th and 12th, what happens is the teachers, if you, you know, don't do your work, etc., they still will point out. But in a university, they could be so indifferent. Like, you have studied here from school onwards, and I've experienced university life outside before coming here, and I know they could be so completely indifferent to whether you come to class. You know, nobody's trying to inquire with you, like, what is it that you're going through that, you know, you're so jaded about your academics that you don't feel like contributing anymore. And that's, you know, that indifference, it just carries through. And so that's how, you know, you now begin to think that when I get into a job, I must try to exploit the people around me. It's like, you know, I'm all alone and I've got to fend for myself.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the messaging from Swami's point of view,
you
know, we can't say that every student who passes out of the portals of this university is like that. Or every student who studies in a university outside is, you know, lacks that ability.
Yes.
But when you are messaging, I think it's important to keep this priority, what Swami says is,
you know, so very important.
Because that's what Swami did, you know, at the end of, say, 5 years or 3 years or 2 years or even 17 years of your education, you got it completely free. And at the end of it, Swami says, all that I want from you is to get a good name.
Yes.
I think in a very subconscious level, we attach the most valuable thing that we can get at the end of this education is to earn a good name. Right? Without our knowledge, probably that you know, messaging gets injected into us.
Yes.
And that's what Swami would often say. You know, I hardly recall Swami asking an old student, how much are you earning?
Even if it was, it was to drive home the message that you got to
right.
save.
And in fact, I recall one of my classmates came back and he was working in the bank. And one morning, Swami came early for bhajans and he was sitting there. And Swami called this boy and Swami asked him, where are you working? He said, Swami, I'm working in such and such a bank. And Swami asked him, how much are they paying you? Right? And this boy told a scale which was not very exorbitant. Right? You know, for his level, actually, he was being paid averagely. So he said that, and Swami's response was, why are they giving you so much? And, you know, the idea was, are you working enough? Are you serving enough for the amount of money that you're getting? You know, that was Swami's response when he asked that boy that day, how much are you earning? And I think, you know, this entire discourse, Swami's talking about students asking questions and asking really wise ones at that. And probably towards the end, Swami's saying, don't think tomorrow you can come and ask me questions like that and I'll be impressed. No, I'll be impressed only by character, only by samskara. Right? So I think we'll conclude with that, as Swami says that. I think next discourse is going to be much more practical, because every discourse of Swami is practical if we choose to practice it, I guess. So I think with that prayer, we'll conclude this discourse. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. Do join us again next week. We'll begin the next discourse, the 9th discourse in that series, next week. A short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishop for the last segment of the day. Stay tuned and happy listening.